What I'd like to do is turn to Exodus 24. We've come through the spring holy days up into Pentecost. And sometimes when we read the Bible, some of these books seem huge and overwhelming. And quite often it's interesting if we read the Bible or read sections of it from a story point of view. And such is the case with the last half of the book of Exodus. And from a timing point of view, the first half obviously starts out with the Passover-related themes, and then into the themes of Pentecost with the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. And we've up until the time of Pentecost, we covered certain areas up to Exodus 24, where Israel accepted the covenant with the law that God gave. But what I'd like to do for today is to go through the last half of the book of Exodus. We're not going to read the whole thing, but there's some interesting things for us to glean from there, and it's quite appropriate for this time of year, because the last half of the book of Exodus occurred at this time of year, after Pentecost and before the Feast of Trumpets. And we'll see that as we go through. So for the bulk of the sermon, except for the last maybe 5 minutes, we'll be in the book of Exodus. And we'll just kind of develop the story as we go. So Exodus 24, we remember that the first 9 verses are all about Israel accepting the covenant. We see in verse 3, Moses came to the people and all of the words of the Lord and all the judgments. And this was, Exodus 20 was the Ten Commandments. But that wasn't just the only part. The next 3 chapters were the basics of the law, basis of the covenant that God was setting with Israel. Laws of how to worship, not just the Ten Commandments, but laws of how to worship and how to interact with one another. How the children of Israel were to interact with one another. There are animal control laws, property laws, ceremonial laws, the feast days. And then in verse 3 here, Moses of 24, of Exodus 24, Moses came and told all the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has said, we will do. Quite simple, they agreed to the covenant. Dropping down to verse 9, I'd like to pick up the story in verse 9. Then Moses went up, and also Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And there, under his feet, as it were a paved work of sapphire stone, and it was like the very heavens in its clarity. But on the nobles of the children of Israel he did not lay his hand. So they saw God, and they ate and drank. Then the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you the tablets of stone, and the law and commandments which I have written, that you may teach them. So we see here as we start out that there were certain leadership levels that God was establishing with the children of Israel. There was Moses, who was clearly the leader at the time. But there were 3 other gentlemen named there, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu. Then there was the group of the 70 elders that were named. And God asked Moses to come up to see him personally up in the mountains. So verse 13, Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, so there's another level of leadership there. And Moses went up to the mountain of God, and he said to the elders, wait for us here until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man has a difficulty, let him go to them. So Joshua accompanies Moses partway up. We'll see later that Moses was by himself with the Lord, but Joshua accompanied him partway, perhaps for various reasons. Moses was over 80 years old at the time, and Joshua was a young man. So he was might have been helping him up into the mountains, because he had to go up into the mountains. So perhaps he needed some help. Perhaps he just needed some company partway. Or God was could have been isolating Joshua as the next in line of leadership, so to speak. So there's various possible reasons. But we see in verse 14 that God had said, you know what? You come up and you let the children of Israel be by themselves, and if they got any issues, they'll go to Aaron or this other man, Hur. So Moses, verse 15, went up into the mountain, and a cloud covered the mountain. Now the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the 7th day he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. And the sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. So Moses went into the midst of the cloud and went up into the mountains, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So this is the time of year that this was occurring. This was after Pentecost, after the receiving of the law, and after Israel had agreed to the covenant, agreed to the not just the Ten Commandments, but the covenant as we read in chapters, as we see in chapters 20 through 23. And then God called Moses and said, you know what? You come up and you be with me for 40 days and 40 nights, and let Israel, a newfound, and their new acceptance of the covenant, you let them work with Aaron and Hur for 40 days, and you come up and see me. And then we won't take time to go through this, but God needed to see where the people were. He was allowing, up until this time, Moses had been the clear leader. Moses had led them out of Egypt, had led them through the Red Sea, had led them up until this point, and had led them through to their acceptance of the covenant. And now they were going to be without their leader for about 40 days, and obviously out without his assistant Joshua. So they were going to be under Aaron the high priest and Hur, who would be there and the 70 elders who would be there to help out. Now we won't take the time to go through chapters 25 through 31. You can do that on your own time. But suffice to say, as we take a glean of it, Moses was up visiting with God for 40 days and 40 nights to learn the system of worship. God was going to reveal to him how he wanted his people to worship. The how, the where, the when, and the whys of how they were going to worship. And they go through, and just by reading the summary, the captions through the chapters as human writers of the Bible have here, we see talking about offerings of the sanctuary, the Ark of the Testimony, how the tabernacle was supposed to be set up, how it was to be constructed, the golden lampstand, then with very detailed plans in chapter 26 on how the tabernacle was supposed to be constructed, inside the tabernacle, the altar, and how it was supposed to be constructed, the different sections of the tabernacle, like the courtyard and the lampstands. So God was being very detailed about how he wanted his people to worship. And there was almost no stone left unturned. How they were going to do it, where they were going to do it, exactly how the structures were to be set up. The garments of the priesthood in chapter 28. So even the leaders were to be dressed a certain way. And there's lessons we can learn if we take time to go in and study the ephod and the breastplate and the different aspects of the priestly garments. Then we flip through to chapter 29. It talks about how Aaron and his sons were set aside as the priesthood. And God then goes in with Moses and talks about how the daily offerings were supposed to occur and what that was supposed to have. And again, just going off of, as you would take time in your studies to go through these six or seven chapters, the different types of oil that were supposed to be used, and the anointing oils, the incense, and all of these different ways that the people were to worship God, because he had, having called them out of foreign worship in the land of Egypt, he had some very specific ways that he wanted them to worship him. And he was taking Moses for 40 days off by himself to spend some time with him and to communicate this through the human leader at the time, which was Moses, so that they could establish a pattern of worship. So now we jump down to, and in chapter 31, actually, before you go there, let's go back to 25, chapter 25. There's a couple of points I wanted to bring up there. As they got into discussing how they were going to make the tabernacle, the Lord said to Moses in chapter 25 and in verse 1, "Speak to the children of Israel that they may bring me an offering. From everyone who gives it willingly with his heart, you shall take my offering. And this is the offering which you shall take from them: gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, fine linen, and goat's hairs, ram skins dyed red, badger skins, acacia wood, oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil and for the sweet incense, onyx stones to be set in the ephod and in the breastplate, and let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. according to all that I show you, that is the pattern of tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings, just so you shall make it. But what's interesting here is we always go through and see the finery of the tabernacle, but it came from the offerings of the people. So it's interesting that we see them as slaves that had left the land of Egypt, but they don't seem to have been poor the way we would think of as slaves, because they had all of this finery that God asked for them to donate for the making of the tabernacle. There are scriptures back in the start of Exodus talk about that, take what you can out of Egypt and get out. So they were not, certainly not poor by any stretch of the imagination, because all of the things that went into the tabernacle, all these finery, the stone, the stones and the gems and the cloth, they certainly weren't poor by any stretch of the imagination. But stuck out in the wilderness, it'd be like in Europe in the 1940s when the Deutschmark was, you needed two wheelbarrows full of Deutschmarks to go buy a loaf of bread. You can have all the money in the world if you want. If there's nowhere to spend it, big deal, I guess, right? It's a moot point. So much like here, they were out in the wilderness, and they were going to be out in the wilderness for years. So they had all of this finery. I suppose big deal. There was nowhere to use it, spend it, trade, or anything like that. So God asked them to use it to build him a sanctuary so that he had a place to dwell with them. So now we see the setup of their 40 years in the wilderness and how they were going to be taken out, set aside for a period of time so that there was no outside distractions, there was no opportunity for them to be distracted with foreign gods, and they would have an opportunity to learn this system of worship that we just briefly went through in those chapters, and learn how to worship God, and learn how to become a friend of God. But it was this pattern, as he says in verse 9, this pattern of the tabernacle and pattern of all the furnishings that they were to learn. Much like the pattern of the law, all of these ways that God was showing them, they were patterns that the people he wanted them to follow. But it was to be used in the service of God. Then we went through, and as we just did, went through chapters 26 through 31. As Moses learned, Moses got all the details, details of how God had, where God wanted them to worship, how the tabernacle was to be set up, how the priesthood was to be set up, all the clothes and the priestly garments and all those sorts of things. And in verse 18 of chapter 31, when he had made an end of speaking with him on Mount Sinai, God, that is, he gave Moses two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone, written with his finger. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down, verse chapter 32 from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us, for as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said, "Break off the golden earrings, which are in the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people broke off the golden earrings, which were in their ears. Again, after all the stuff that they had donated for the temple, they still had enough gold to break off and donate for the purposes of building this golden calf. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. Then they said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord." Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings, and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. So some comments here. If we go back to chapter 24, you just take your, just go back a little bit. And we read there that Moses, God, through Moses, had left Aaron and Hur in charge of the people. Said, if they have any issues, have them come up and see you, and Aaron and Hur will make the decisions and guide them in the right way. So going back to chapter 32, now these people, now they hadn't been out of Egypt for very long. They had followed this guy Moses for a few months into the wilderness, and we know from our Passover studies and the time after the Passover, all of their complaints. So they had followed this Savior in Moses who was leading them out of Egypt, and he had done nothing but get them into other stuff that they weren't banking on. So now they're stuck in the wilderness, and he's gone off to the mountains, and who knows what's up there, whether a wild animal could have gotten him. But they made this commitment to God, and now as soon as they make the commitment to God through from their leader Moses, he vanishes, and he's gone for 40 days. So now, who do they turn to? Because their faith isn't strong enough yet. They're just babes in the faith, or as Paul says, babes in Christ, not in Christ at this time, but similar as we would say it today, babes in Christ. So they go and they say, make us gods. Small g gods. Elohim is the same word as used in some other places for God. Here, it's the same word, Elohim. Make us gods that shall go before us. For as this Moses has brought us up here and we don't know where he is, so you make us gods that we can follow God, small g. Well, notice what Aaron said. Aaron said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. So these are new Israelites, just new people in this covenant. Aaron had Aaron had a better understanding of God because he had, obviously completely wrong, but he had done a feast to the Lord, to Yahweh here. But the people, they weren't looking to worship Yahweh. They were looking to worship gods. Find us any god for us to worship. Obviously, man has a need to fill that space within them to follow a god. And here, because Moses had gone and scampered off, their commitment wasn't strong enough, and they were looking to just find any god to follow. But much like Adam, when Eve came to him, Aaron did much the same thing. The people came and said, here, make us gods. Aaron had a choice. Aaron could have said, we don't follow the Lord because Moses says to follow the Lord. We follow the Lord because we've committed to following God ourselves. And here, Aaron decides that I can't have, perhaps it almost seems like he can't handle the pressure from some of the pressure from the people. So he's going to try to compromise his belief system by allowing some of their belief system to come in. And that's, of course, where God, throughout the Old Testament, gets upset with his people, where we start to compromise our belief system and try to incorporate other belief systems into the right system, the right belief system. And he was only gone for 40 days. And within 40 days, they had lost such complete sight that they were now fashioning this golden calf to worship any type of god. Now, obviously, with the Egyptian god system, perhaps the cow was one animal that the Egyptians had worshipped, and this was probably one of the animals that came to mind first. But in Aaron's mind, it was an image of God, because he said here, we are going to have a feast to the Lord, not to God, small g, like the Israelite, that the Israelites did. But Aaron, he was trying to combine the two into one. And he said, you know, tomorrow we're going to celebrate a feast to the Lord. Now, we know much later that God says you don't add or subtract to my law. You don't add and subtract to anything that I've given you. But this word for the Lord, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord, is the word Yehovah or Yahweh, which is the self-existent one. So Aaron was still trying to serve the God of Israel, but had compromised in allowing the Egyptians or the Israelites to fashion this calf. Man's need for God, man's need for a god came into play here, and they weren't patient enough or committed enough in their young lives of this commitment to stay true to God's way. And they were combining the worship of the true God with foreign religions. And we see in verse 7, God's wrath. And the Lord said to Moses, God says to Moses, get down there, for your people, whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt. It's interesting now, a few chapters on, we'll see that Moses makes the comment that he communicated with God as a friend. And we can see that right from here, because now they're kind of going back and forth here. And it's interesting as we see the dynamic being played out here, where God says, you get down there, because the people you took out of Egypt, like Moses had any choice in the matter. He didn't even want to be part of it. But now it's his fault, it seems. For your people, whom you've brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I have commanded them. You haven't even gone 40 days, and they've already turned completely away from what we had told them. They've made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, this is your God, O Israel, that you brought out of the land of Egypt. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, let me alone, leave me be, so that my wrath may not burn against them, that I may consume them, and I will make of you a great nation. If I get any closer to this, I am going to just utterly destroy them, and I'll take you, Moses, and I will make this great nation that I promise, and it'll come completely out of you. So now Moses here, we see the dynamic of Moses here as we get into this. Moses acts as part intercessor and part leader. Right now the intercessor comes to play here. And as I studied this and went through this, God obviously is in complete control. He doesn't sin, he doesn't get angry for no reason. It's my opinion, and this is strictly opinion from reading the story, that God was trying to draw this out of Moses. Whether he would have consumed them or not, who knows? He did in the flood, and he said he would never do anything like that again, but with a flood. Perhaps he would have done it with fire. But here we see Moses as a leader develop. And we see that here where Moses, in verse 11, pleads with God and says, Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you've brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak and say, he brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains, to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. So now he's telling God, if we do this, now Moses is so committed to this, he's part of this plan with God now. And he says, if we do this, your name's looking bad here. So if you come and let your anger get all out of sorts, I don't think God would have done that. We see countless times here where God is not that way. But perhaps, in my opinion, he was trying to draw this out of Moses and see what kind of leader Moses was going to be. So now Moses, the friend of God, stands up to God and says, we can't be doing this. Your name is going to look bad here. At some point, I think it's in Deuteronomy, but I think it's earlier too, that Israel is to be called out and to be looked up to by all the nations around them, to be this special nation that God was working with. Moses, he had bought into that, and he knew that. So now he's saying to God, we do this, your name looks completely bad. They draw them out, one little thing, he's going to wipe them off the other. Who's going to want to serve that God? So Moses intervenes. Remember, verse 13, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self. You said this yourself, he says. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of, I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So he's pleading with God to think about what he's going to do here, to in Moses' mind, see the error of his ways, in Moses' mind, to see how this would be a wrong thing to do, to wipe Israel off the map. So God relented from the harm which he said he would do to his people. Now, whether God would or not, we could be fun to talk about. We can't really say one way or the other. I kind of like to think God was never going to do it, and he was more working with Moses, but that's my speculation, and that's nothing more than speculation. Verse 15, leadership comes now to Moses. God has stepped back a little bit, and now let Moses be the leader. So now Moses, as the intercessor, has done his job as the intercessor. Now he's the leader. And we see him come down as a leader. And Moses went down. He's already telling God, don't you get involved here and don't wipe them off the map. But let me deal with it. And he dealt with it. Moses turned and went down from the mountain. And the two tablets of the testimony were in his hand. And the tablets were written on both sides. And on the one side and on the other they were written. Now the tablets were the work of God. And the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. We're going to come back to that because there's something else that comes up later on in the story. But notice here, God cut the stone and God wrote this out. So these are the actual handiwork of God given to Moses to give to the people. And when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there's a noise of... So Moses has come down partway. He's met up with Joshua again because remember, Joshua went with him, but then... It doesn't say Joshua has to stay, but God said, Moses, you come up by yourself. So it seems to be some sort of separation from wherever Joshua went. Much like when you climb Mount Everest, there's an encampment part of the way up. And perhaps it was something like that where Joshua went part way and Moses went the rest of the way. So Moses comes back down. Joshua says, there's a noise of war in the camp. But he said, it's not the noise of the shout of victory, nor the noise of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing I hear. They could just tell that something was amiss. It wasn't... There was no battle had gone on. There was just something's wrong down there. So it was, as soon as he came near the camp, so you can see them come over the crest of a mountain, let's say, the path coming down, and they see this celebration with all sorts of nasty stuff going on and worshiping this calf, this golden calf. And he saw the calf and the dancing, and now the intercessor is gone. God has relented, but Moses is not going to relent. As the leader here, it's his job to get the message across. And Moses' anger became so hot that he cast the tablets, the very handiwork of God, out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. You can imagine how angry Moses was with the people, that he, how special this was to have God's handiwork. He had cut the stone out himself and he absolutely smashed these tablets. He was so angry. Then he took the calf, and they were never going to forget this lesson. He took the calf that they had made, burned it in the fire, ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the children of Israel drink it. And Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you've brought so great a sin upon them?" So now, he's mad at the people, but now he turns to the guy he left in charge and said, "What in the world did you do? What were you thinking?" And much like Adam, this sounds a whole lot like God going to Adam and saying, "Yeah, they did it, but I left you in charge. And what did you do?" Here, "Don't let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people that are set on it." And here, this word for Lord, small l, is Adon. It's a short form of the word Adonai, which means sovereign or master. Much like they call, like the a laird or a lord of what we see today. "Don't let the anger of my Lord become hot." So clearly, Aaron knew his place. He knew Moses was in charge because he referred to him as my Lord. You know these people. They are set on evil. That was his excuse. You know these. We've been with them for X number of months out here. You know what these people are like. They're set on evil. "For they said to me," this is unbelievable, that, now I'm sure we've all done this. I don't know what I did, but this sounds like something I would have done at some point in my life. Hopefully not recently, but maybe. "They said to me, 'Make us gods that they shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him.'" So far, it's okay. They said, "Make us gods. We don't know where this Moses guy is. Make us gods." "So I said, 'If you have any gold, just break it off.' And we dumped it in this fire, and all of a sudden, boom, this calf comes out of nowhere." Aaron was Moses' older brother. I can't imagine if there was a little a cuff of some kind here, but this is absolutely ridiculous. "Now when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them. So there's, the people have a responsibility here, but Aaron had a responsibility as leader too, to point out that they needed to be restrained, to their shame among their enemies. And again, to their shame among the enemies. The whole point here wasn't just the fact that they were disobeying God, but they were going to bring dishonor to God's name, because Israel was supposed to be this group of people that was to be a shining light, that was to obey God and show that God's way works. And not less than 40 days after they had committed, they had gone right off the deep end again. "Then Moses stood in the entrance of the camp and said, 'Whoever is on the Lord's side, come to me.' And all of the sons of Levi gathered themselves together to him. And he said, 'Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let every man put his sword on his side and go in and out from entrance to entrance throughout the camp. And let every man kill his brother, every man his companion, and every man his neighbor.' So the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Then Moses says, 'Consecrate yourselves today to the Lord, that he may bestow upon you a blessing this day, for every man has opposed his son and his brother.'" So a couple of comments here. 3,000 men were casualties of God's punishment. Now there were millions of Israelites. The count was 2 million at some point that in studies and certain things. So why 3,000 men? We see throughout the Old Testament, and this is I heard a message by Bronson James that I'm going to somehow adapt to bring here because I thought it was an interesting one. Different levels of sin in the Old Testament. Why some sin can be covered with the blood of an animal, but other sins was outright stoning or death. Because there are some sins that are done unwilling, done just the human nature. We flib up a little bit. We make a mistake. We don't really mean to dishonor or disobey God, but we're human beings and we do. It is those types of sin that can be, that in with Israel at this point, that could be covered with the blood of a lamb or an animal. But there were some sins that were so ingrained in people that it would be a generational thing, where so much sin, and again, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, and I'm not going to be explaining it completely right, because it's just I'm on a tangent right now. But these 3,000 men were probably the leaders of this party. We have got some younger people here, so we don't want to go into exactly what was going on here. But if you see, you can read what was going on here, and there was some just decay and absolute downright awful sins that they were doing. And these 3,000 men were probably so at the core of this that God needed to out of His mercy, have their physical lives come to an end, because there will come a point down, we know, in the plan of God where that He will be able to work with them again. But Israel needed to see that this was such an awful sin, such an awful separation between them and God, that the leaders of this party needed to have their physical lives ended at this point, so that the nation could grow and flourish as a proper nation. Because what was going on here was so bad, Moses broke the Ten Commandments, the very handiwork of God. So somebody had to be penalized for this. And this isn't a onerous, mean God of the Old Testament that we sometimes hear about. This is a merciful God who, for the 2 million less 3,000 other people, needed to let them have a chance to learn His ways. And these 3,000 men paid the price with their physical lives at that point. But Moses here is setting it up here, saying, who are you following? Are you following God, or are we going to follow this way of life? Now down to verse 30. It came to pass on the next day that Moses said to the people, you have committed a great sin. So he's was in leadership mode. He was intercessor with God, where he stepped in on behalf of Israel and saved them from what God said He was going to do to them. He gets into leadership mode and comes down and takes care of the problem. Now he goes back into intercessor mode here. You've committed a great sin, so now I will go up to God, and perhaps I can make an atonement for your sin. The 3,000 people that likely were at the heart of this, the most evil of them, they had paid with their lives. But now we've got 1 million, well, we don't know that there was 2 million, I'm just going off the studies. We got 2 million other people here who need to see that this is God's way of life. So now I will go up to the Lord, perhaps I can make an atonement for your sin. So Moses returned to God and said, oh, these people have committed a great sin and have made for themselves a god of gold. Yet now, if you will forgive their sin, but if not, I pray, blot me out of your book, which you have written. Remember what God said? God said, I'm going to blot all of them out, and I will start with you. Moses went up and said, let them all live and blot me out. If someone has to die, I'll do it. I'll pay my life so that these people have a chance. A leader and an intercessor all in one. And we see the type of leader Moses was becoming, and why God chose Moses to lead His people into this first part of their existence as the children of Israel. If you will forgive their sin, great. But if not, let me pay the price. I will pay the price so that they may live. And God said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. Now therefore, go lead the people to the place which I have spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day which I visit for punishment, I will visit punishment upon them for their sin. As with all sin, there can be forgiveness, but that doesn't mean we don't pay a physical price for natural laws that we break. Now, whether this was a physical punishment for sin or whether this was a spiritual punishment, we don't know. But even with forgiveness, and God said here, Moses is pleading for forgiveness, that doesn't mean that there wasn't some sort of physical price to pay for doing things the wrong way. So the Lord plagued the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron made. So He did bestow upon them some sort of physical punishment in the form of a plague, because of the calf And Israel knew, we come to see here that Israel knew what it was. They knew why this was bestowed upon them. And we'll see that as we come to that. Then the Lord said to Moses, chapter 33, "Depart and go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt, to the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your descendants I will give it. And I will send my angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanite, the Amorite, the Hittite, the various people that would surround them and perhaps prevent them from attaining the promised land. So that verse 3, you can go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, for I will not go up in your midst, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people." So again, here his mercy is coming out here, that he's going to not go up himself in the midst of them. God will not go up himself in the midst of them, but he is going to send a messenger to lead them himself, to lead them, so that he doesn't get so angry at them again that he wipes them off the face of the earth again. This onerous God that we hear is really a very, very merciful God. And when the people, verse 4, heard this bad news, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments. So they got the message here that God was removing himself from their presence for a little bit. God himself was not going to be part of their presence. And no one put on his ornaments. And that some of these ornaments were some of the same things that they had donated to this golden calf and some of this jewelry and stuff. For the Lord had said to Moses, "Say to the children of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. I could come up into your midst in one moment and consume you. Now therefore, take off your ornaments that I may know what to do to you." Who are you following? Are you following your old way of life? Or are you going to commit 100% to my way of life? And the children of Israel, they got the lesson at this point, and they stripped themselves of their ornaments by Mount Horeb. So by removing them, it was a sense of repentance that they were going to change their way of life, and they were going to commit to this way of life that God wanted them to commit to. So verse 7, Moses took his tent and pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp, and called the tabernacle of meeting. And it came to pass that everyone who sought the Lord went out to the tabernacle of meeting, which was outside the camp. And so it was, whenever Moses went out to the tabernacle, that all the people rose. Each man stood at his tent door and watched Moses until he had gone into the tabernacle. So you can imagine this great big open field and the centerpiece to the tabernacle. People were just watching what Moses was doing, because he was clearly the leader. They had got that lesson, and they were going to follow. They were going to follow Moses. And it came to pass when Moses entered the tabernacle, verse 9, that the pillar of cloud descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Lord talked with Moses. Remember, this pillar of cloud was the same one that had led them out of Egypt. So they knew what this pillar of cloud was. So after this incident with the golden calf and their heads getting out of sorts, they were back in line, and they knew that this pillar of cloud that was outside Moses' tent, was outside the tabernacle when Moses entered, they knew this was God's presence with Moses. Obviously not God himself, because God said he wasn't going to be with them, but his angel and his messenger. All the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the tabernacle, and all the people rose and worshipped, each man at his tent door. So they knew this was the presence of God, and they worshipped at their own door. So Moses, the Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. And we've seen that as we've seen the development of Moses as a leader in Israel here, that they had a type of friendship where they could banter back and forth. And he would return to the camp, but his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle. So again, we're seeing the lead up of Joshua to be the person who takes over for Moses. And now we see a little bit more of the interaction of God with Moses. Moses says to the Lord, "See, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found grace in my sight. Now therefore, I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know you, and that I may find grace in your sight, and consider that this nation is your people." So again, now we got Moses is back into his intercessor mode, where he is acting on behalf of the people as their leader. He's acting on behalf of them in front of God. And God said, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." Obviously, the rest, not just rest at that time and peace, but also looking forward to the time when he would give them the promised land. Then he said to him, Moses said to God, if your presence does not go with us, do not bring us up from here. And now we got Moses. Moses is leading on behalf of his people, bantering here a little bit with God. For how then, verse 16, will it be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight, except you go with us? So we shall be separate, your people and I, from all the people who are upon the face of the earth. So the Lord said to Moses, I will also do this thing that you have found, for you have found grace in my sight, and I know you by name. And he said, please show me your glory. And then we get into the story about how God blocks off Moses' eyesight just a little bit, and just sort of, he kind of hides him in a crevice of the rock, and he kind of passes in front of him just to give Moses a small glimpse of what this glory of God really is like. And I'm sure it was nothing compared to what his glory really is like, because he says here, in verse 20, you cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live. But here is a place by me, and you shall stand on the rock, and so it shall be when my glory passes by, that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and cover you with my hand while I pass by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face cannot be seen. So we see now Moses and God are not only is he their leader and their intercessor, but Moses himself has developed such a commitment to God that they are friends, and he sees God, and God treats him as a friend, much like we know later on in the New Testament, Christ and his disciples talked about. I now don't call you servants, but I call you my friend. Moses had that same relationship with God. So now we see God says to Moses in chapter 34, and keep in mind what we read a little bit before. We read that the original tablets were cut out by God himself and handwritten by God and chiseled in, however God did it with his hand. Verse 34, cut two tablets of stone like the first ones. Now it's Moses' job to cut the stone. I'm not a stonemason. Moses is up in the mountains, likely with very little tools. How he did it, I don't know. But this is not just some sort of one line here. This was Moses representing the people. Someone was going to now have to cut the stones themselves. God did it once. He's not going to do it a second time. He has Moses cut the stone himself. I think that's significant. Not only for Moses and understanding how important the law was, but as he goes on and leads his people, he can impact upon them just how hard it was to recreate these commandments that are so precious that I had to cut these stones myself because we blew it the first time. God provided these two tablets himself, and you sinned, and I got so angry with you that we just shattered the tablets. Now I had to cut them again myself. I'm sure that was part of the lesson that he would go on to teach his people. It doesn't say, of course, that's speculation on my part. But it's significant here that God makes Moses cut the tablets the second time. And I will write on these tablets, God says, I will write on these tablets the words that were on the first ones, which you broke. So we're going to try this again. God is so merciful, he's constantly giving us second chances. So be ready in the morning and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself to me there on top of the mountain. And no man shall come up with you, and let no man be seen through all the mountain. Let neither flocks nor herds feed before that mountain. So this is his holy mountain. This is him and Moses. Again, for the second time, come on up and we're going to try this again. So verse 4, he cut two tablets of stone like the first ones. Then Moses rose early in the morning and went up to Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him, and he took in his hand the two tablets of stone. So the Lord descended in a cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And he passed by before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression. This is a God that had wiped out 3,000 people for the gravity of their sin, that was ready to, in his words to Moses, wipe them all out. But he is the keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving an iniquity and transgression and sin, by no means clearing the guilty, that there is justice and there is mercy. And God is a God of justice as much as he is a God of mercy. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. So Moses, and that little statement there is part of the discussion of sin that, if I can find a copy of Bronson's message, we'll do. Otherwise, we'll study it ourselves. So Moses made haste and bowed his head toward the earth in worship. Then he said, "If now I have found grace in your sight, O Lord, let my Lord, I pray, go among us, even though we are stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as your inheritance." So again, the intercessory part of Moses kicks in, and he's pleading for God to relent and be with come with them himself. Even though, he says, we are a stiff-necked people. Please forgive our stiff-neckedness, he said, and just come with us. We think of the impact this has on Moses as a leader. He was a prince of Egypt, and he learned how to lead from a human point of view throughout his first 40 years as he grew up in the palaces of Egypt. But he grew so much as a leader from the time he took the children. This was the one who stuttered, that did not want to lead these people out, who is now bantering back and forth and bargaining with God on behalf of his people. And he said, "Behold, I will make a covenant." God said, verse 10, "Behold, I will make a covenant before all your people. I will do marvels such as has not been done in all the earth, nor in any nation. And all the people among whom you are shall see the work of God, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. Observe what I command you this day. Behold, I am driving out from before you the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you're going." Again, he knew their proclivity to lose focus on his way of life and perhaps make a covenant with other gods. So there was an addendum to the agreement here that you cannot make an agreement. You cannot go in with these other gods. So then the kind of reiterating the covenant. We won't go through this part here, chapter 34. He's reiterating parts of the covenant that they're going to agree to. And then drop down to verse 27. God said to Moses, "Write these words, for according to the tenor of these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel." And so he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water. And God wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. So we remember he was up there for an original 40 days, where he got the ins and the outs of how to worship, where to worship, what the priests were to be dressed in, and all the little intricacies of the rituals of their worship. So now he goes up again for another 40 days. So we count these 80 days from Pentecost. This has taken us clear right up, almost up to, and I haven't done the calculations, but it takes us right through much of the summer months that we would experience now. So what we've read, while we see the scriptures and these books of the Bible as being these grandiose books, the last half of the book of Exodus is just the story of what happened after they got the Ten Commandments through what we would call the summer months right now, the 80 days after Pentecost, which is what we're into right now. And he takes Moses up for another 40 days to revisit his system of worship, because it was so important that they understood exactly how to worship God, where to worship God, when to worship God, if they were going to commit to this covenant. Down to chapter 35. So from chapter 35 through chapter 40, we go through, and there's more what this is here. Let's read chapter 35 and verse 1. "Moses gathered all the congregation of the children of Israel together and said to them, 'These are the words which the Lord has commanded you to do. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh shall be a holy day for you.'" Now, we won't go into that. But now, when Moses was up for those 40 days, the first 40 days and the second 40 days, he now comes down to Israel, and he now goes through it with them. All the stuff that God had taught him in the while he was up by himself in the mountains. And he goes through God's expectations of worship with the children of Israel. And we see that in verse chapter 35, chapter 36, chapter 37, a retelling of what Moses had learned, how to build the tabernacle, the making of the Ark of the Testimony, the table for the showbread. They were learning the system of worship that God was going to expect of them. Down to chapter, how the temple was to be erected, the artisans that were chosen to put all of the offerings of the people together and make this tabernacle. We come down to chapter 40 and verse 33. And he raised up the court all around the tabernacle and the altar and hung up the screen of the court gate. So Moses finished the work. So now they have completely constructed what God wanted them to construct, the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant, all of these other things that he had them construct, the priestly garments, and the work was done. So now they were about to embark upon this system of worship that they were going to worship God as part of their covenant with him. Then verse 34, then the cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tabernacle of meeting, because the cloud rested above it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Whenever the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle, the children of Israel would go onward in all their journeys. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not journey till the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was above the tabernacle by day, and the fire over it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all of their journeys. So the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire were back as evidence of God's presence with them and what God wanted them to do. But we notice here that once they committed back in chapter 24 that whatever you say we will do, God wasn't looking for an answer whether they would agree to this again. They had committed when God said, here's my law, here's what we're going to do. Here's my and we went through that. We go through that when you read chapters 20 through 23, the essence of the covenant, the Ten Commandments, the Sabbath, the holy days, the interaction of the people, how they were expected to treat one another. It's not just Sabbath and holy days that the covenant was about. It was about personal interaction, how the agreement was going to be, how the congregation of the assembly of Israel was to treat each other. Then when Moses gets to this explaining the system of worship, this wasn't a covenant. This wasn't an agreeable part. They had already agreed to the covenant before. Moses had just described it to them. Built the tabernacle, built the ephod, created all these things that they built together with the artisans. And we notice here what's interesting, there was no reaction from Israel. They weren't expected to okay this. This was God's system of worship. And God wasn't looking for an answer. He was only looking for following and obedience. And it was they had their instructions on how things were to be there. So what relevance does this have for us today? I was when I found this, I was looking through to a timely portion of scripture that reflects the time of year that we're in now, the portion after Pentecost as we lead into the holy days, as into the fall holy days. Let's go to Matthew chapter 24, because there is some relevance for us today. We've come through an exciting few months, the last few months here, not just in the keeping of the holy days, but here in Ottawa. We had our preparation for Passover, our keeping of Passover here, and then the spring holy days that followed. And then once that was done, we had the preparation lead up to Bill Watson's visit and the exciting weekend that we had. And then from there, we immediately went into preparing ourselves for Pentecost and lead up into the celebration of the feast day of Pentecost. So as we look back and think, this has been a very busy few months for us as a group, not only for us as a group, for us as individual Christians through the plan of God here and our keeping of the holy days. We've now got a four-month summer between now and the fall holy days where we go on our vacations. I personally won't be here several weeks during the summer due to family vacations and other commitments. Sometimes we'll go our separate ways. We see here today, we've got, believe it or not, as full as the room is, we've got 8 regulars missing from us now. So we go into this period of summer months, much like the winter months between the two holy day periods. And we use the holy day periods as a beacon of God's way of life. And we keep them every year so that we keep on track with God's way of life. Matthew 24 has a lesson for us to learn that Israel needed to learn when Moses went up into the mountain. And verse 45 tells us, who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. We've got a beautiful summer coming up. We've got lots of personal activities to do, comings and goings. We've got, it seems like it's going to be a long time before the next Holy Day and Feast of Trumpets, and then quickly after that, Atonement and Tabernacles. But we can't lose focus during these summer months. Much like Israel had committed to God's way of life, and then Moses left, there was an absence of, I hesitate to use the word spirituality, but there was an absence of leadership. There was a change that occurred with the people of Israel. And God was testing their commitment without Moses. Were they following God because they were following Moses? Moses said to follow God. So when Moses wasn't there, what were they going to do? And when Moses wasn't there, instantly, their commitment showed that they needed to understand commitment a little bit better. It was easy to be right when Moses was around. Moses was clearly the leader. We see what type of leader he became. It was easy to fall in line right away when Moses was there. It's easy for us to when we go through a heightened Holy Day period or a heightened when we've got guest speakers come in, it's easy to be diligent with our studies, be diligent with our self-examination, be diligent with following God's way of life. When we've got Passover and then we count down to Pentecost and then we've got the... But as we go through these summer months, it might be easy to take a week off. It might be feel nice to just kick back and, you know what, I won't... I'll pray tomorrow. Or I'll read my Bible tomorrow. It's a nice, bright, sunny day out. The deck is beckoning. There's cold beer in the fridge. I'll do it tomorrow. And then tomorrow, it's going to be just as nice and sunny tomorrow. And then, you know what? I can do it tomorrow. Blessed is he who, when his master comes, and when his master comes, clearly his master wasn't there. Much like Moses wasn't there, the way it's worded here, blessed is he when the master comes, finds him so doing. God expects us to be diligent at all times. He expects us to have a heightened sense of following him, regardless of who's watching us. Whether Moses is there beside us, or whether Moses is off in the mountains and we have no idea where he went. Whether we're gone on vacation for 2 weeks and we won't be around any church people, so I'm just going to slack a bit and I can read my Bible tomorrow or I can pray tomorrow. We've got the long drawn out days of summer coming. We may not see each other every week. We may not have that opportunity to sharpen each other's iron, which we do so well here. Blessed is he who, when his master comes, finds him so doing. We don't know when God is coming back, but much like Israel learned when Moses was gone for 40 days, it doesn't matter where Moses is. Moses could have died in the mountains. He could have been a victim of a cougar attack in the mountains. God expected them to follow him regardless of who was there. It's easy to get caught up in things, abandon our worship. And when I say abandon our worship, I don't mean the coming to church. Our worship is praying to God on a daily basis, studying his Bible, becoming, as we read in Genesis 1, becoming after his likeness and after his image. But true worship, which is following God every day of our lives. Blessed are those who, when the Master comes, will find us so doing. This is a lesson learned from the second half of the book of Exodus, which occurred during the summer months of whatever year that was, at that very time of year. And it's fitting as we embark upon a summer now.